Welcome back to The Europeans, the podcast about the lovable mess that is this continent. This is Katie in Paris, where it is still raining, and on the other end of the line, in Amsterdam, it's Dominic Kramer. How are you doing?
I'm okay. People have finally started wearing masks in Amsterdam this week.
That's exciting. Positive developments.
Obviously not everyone, and they're rather late to the party, but I've noticed a difference. I couldn't believe it.
Behavioural change is possible.
How are you?
I'm good. I went to a Zoom party this week, which felt quite retro. Do you remember Zoom parties?
Oh, wow. That is old school.
Very early pandemic.
Are they coming back in?
Apparently so. But it was really nice, actually. I saw some really old friends and laughed a lot. And it reaffirmed my faith in the internet as a force for good sometimes, which connects people. So that was nice.
That sounds really nice. Maybe one day I'll be invited to a Zoom party.
Once you stop being so grumpy. What's coming up this week, Dominic?
Today we have a food-themed episode for you all, starting with a meaty good week and a sweet bad week. And then we'll be dialing up the Skype machine for a milky interview. We're going to be speaking to the documentary filmmaker Fredrik Gerten from his home in Malmö, a city that just so happens to be the home of the enormously successful vegan food brand Oatly. And you may or may not have heard that Oatly have been coming under quite a bit of criticism recently after Blackstone, the controversial and enormous private equity firm, bought a 10% stake in this plant-based dairy alternative company. Fredrik will be talking to us later on in the show about Oatly, Blackstone, and broadly the growing international property crisis we are currently living in.
Yay!
Yay!
But first, it's a food-themed Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Who's had a good week, Dominic?
It's been a good week for meat alternatives in Germany. A study published in the scientific journal Foods revealed that 42% of Germans are at least to some extent trying to cut down on their meat consumption, be it vegetarianism, pescatarianism or flexitarianism, a term which I think people still roll their eyes at, but which I think we shouldn't be rolling our eyes at because it could play a big part in the battle for saving our planet through the absolutely necessary reduction of meat farming and consumption. I found the results of this study quite surprising because I still think of Germany as a pretty meat-loving country with all those schnitzels and all that Wurst.
Wurst.
42% of people trying to cut down on meat was higher than I thought it would be. And on top of that, people who identify as full meat eaters are now in the minority in Germany, according to this study, which is pretty wild.
Hmm.
Christopher Bryant, a psychologist who worked on the study, suggested to The Guardian that we might be at a tipping point in German food culture. He said, "The view that being a carnivore is normal is part of the lay moral reasoning for continuing to eat meat. But once that is a minority view and meat replacement options become cheaper and tastier, the trend is likely to continue in one direction." So this study was actually a comparison of views on meat between Germany and France. And I'm sorry to say, Katie, this may come as no surprise to you, that France has much further to go than Germany. Whilst only 45% of people surveyed in Germany identified as omnivores, in France that number is at 68.5%. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me. Although I will say it's definitely much better than it used to be in France. Like, there's usually one or two pretty good vegetarian options on restaurant menus these days, which definitely didn't used to be the case. And also something I've noticed in bookshops is that there's a massive vegetarian section now in the cookbook section. And I think that's a good sign.
I think people like Otto Lengi have really helped that. He also cooks meat, but he kind of promotes this flexitarianism.
Celebrates the vegetable.
Absolutely. So this study ties in with what we've seen with book sale figures and with food sale figures. In the first quarter of this year, the sale of vegan food rose by 37% in Germany, which is pretty huge. And one in every 10 new food products on the German market is now vegan.
Wow.
The study was actually not about this topic. It was actually mainly looking at what people's opinions were on cultured meat, the next big thing that could help save our ailing planet. What are your thoughts on cultured meat, or do you know what it is?
Is this like meat grown in a lab?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I feel kind of fine about that. If like no animals died, but it's still a delicious burger, then sure, I'll eat it.
Well, you are kind of the view that the study discovered was quite common, that basically people in France and Germany seemed to be pretty open to the idea of consuming cultured meat. And one argument that was particularly persuasive in favour of cultured meat is around antibiotics and the fact that cultured meat gets rid of that pretty terrifying problem that we are living with now, whereby antibiotic resistance is growing because of the willy-nilly use of antibiotics in livestock.
Can you actually buy this cultured lab-grown meat in Europe anywhere?
No, you can't yet. It still needs to clear the EU regulatory bodies, but analysts hope that this might happen in the next few years. I'm open to giving it a try, and I'd be joined by people who work in the meat industry, apparently, as they were in this survey, the group most likely to be open to cultured meat.
Oh.
And I guess that's because they see how awful the conditions are in livestock and the slaughtering of animals. Currently.
That's a pretty grim indictment.
Yeah. So anyway, let's leave it there. Who's had a bad week?
I'm giving bad week to the US sandwich chain Subway because of quite a fun court ruling in Ireland, which you've possibly already heard about because it went viral. The Irish Supreme Court has ruled that Subway bread is not bread. Have you ever had a Subway sandwich?
Of course.
What was your favourite?
Oh, having said of course I know this is a Subway. I don't remember the names.
You're a Subway fraud. You've never had a Subway sandwich. You're just trying to look at your sort of the earth.
I've probably only had them about 10 times in my life.
I actually had a summer job while we were at university where I got paid partly in Subway sandwiches. So I've eaten a lot of Subway.
Oh, I actually have a relative who worked at Subway in America, and the smell, because you know they pump out that smell into the street.
Delicious bread smell, or not bread smell.
No, sugar smell to persuade people to come in. She said that she smelt of that constantly, even over the weekend, the smell wouldn't disappear. And it now makes her feel very sick whenever she passes the store.
I can imagine. I can imagine that other people quite liked it, though. Like, it probably made her quite attractive.
Yeah, I love that smell.
You mentioned the sweetness of this smell. The sweetness of the bread is apparently also the problem. Because the Irish Supreme Court has ruled that Subway's bread is too sweet to call itself bread. It actually contains 5 times too much sugar to legally call itself bread. A full 10% of the weight of the flour that's used to make it. How do we know this? Well, apparently the Irish franchisee of Subway, a company called Bookfinders Limited, they were in court because they were trying to argue that their sandwiches should be exempt from value-added tax because bread is a staple food under Irish law, and staple foods in Ireland are exempt from VAT. Something else called discretionary indulgences are not exempt. And in case you're wondering what discretionary indulgences are, it's like ice cream, chocolate, crisps, all my favourite things, basically. It's actually my birthday next week. You should buy me a hamper of discretionary indulgences.
I'll just buy you a few Subway vouchers. There was a similar battle in the UK a few years ago, wasn't there, around certain biscuits that were categorised as cakes?
Jaffa cakes.
Yeah.
I think in the end they ruled in favour of Jaffa cakes being a cake, a chocolate-covered cake, rather than a chocolate-covered biscuit, which is considered a luxury.
Aha, that's it. Just going back a step, did you say that the Irish franchise chain is called Bookfinders?
Yeah, very weird. And I've been Googling around and I found very little info. I don't really understand why a company called Bookfinders is running Subways. If anybody has the answers to that, give me a shout.
Anyway, it's a much more fun Supreme Court ruling than the horror that's coming up in the American version of the court.
It definitely is. Thank you, Irish Supreme Court, for bringing us some much-needed entertainment this week.
What did Subway say in response to this ruling?
They've put out a quite funny and rebellious statement. According to a spokesman, Subway's bread is, of course, bread. That's all they have to say about the matter. So what is it if it's not bread? That much is unclear to me. Is it cake? Doesn't feel right to put meatballs on a cake, though, does it?
Funnily enough, I made a savoury bread pudding last night.
Oh, lovely.
It was like a cheesy, kidney beany, vegetable-y thing with bread in it and milk and egg.
Sounds like a mess.
That sounds disgusting, doesn't it?
Yeah. We'll have to take your word for it.
We have some new Patreons to thank. Thank you so much, Rebecca Florison, Holly Hibbert, and Ksenia Kurileva, for joining our merry band of Patreons We are so grateful to all of you that are able to spare a few dollars, pounds or euros. It is now possible to pay in three currencies. Sadly, not the others, I'm afraid, yet. Without you guys, this show wouldn't be happening anymore. We're not backed by any huge media organization, unfortunately. We just set this up ourselves and we're just a little podcast. So any little helps a lot. So if you'd like to join them, then please head to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. We're also really grateful to everyone who have changed their currency this week. And some of them, in the meantime, have upped their monthly donation, which is so sweet. I got like a stream of really nice emails.
We're rich.
Not quite.
Thank you so much, everyone. It was really amazing to receive all of these lovely emails in our inbox. Becoming a supporter of this podcast not only means you get to help ensure that we're able to keep making it, there's also a bunch of stuff you get depending on how much you pledge. Postcards and little voice messages from me and Dominic, and access to our secret Facebook group, which I'm pretty sure is the nicest place on Facebook these days. People generally post like interesting articles from all around Europe. But it has also recently, and fittingly for this episode, ventured into food recommendations. I think people were swapping ideas for what to do with buckwheat flour, which is popular in Eastern Europe, I think. So yeah, join us there for cooking recommendations and much more besides. On to the main course. See what I did there, Dominic?
I see just what you did.
I'm not actually a big consumer of oat milk, I have to confess, but probably the one brand of oat milk I would recognise on the shelf is Oatly, a Swedish brand. Its branding, I guess, is kind of somewhere between like hipster and friendly. Would you agree with that?
Borderline annoying.
Why did you say that?
Well, they're always so pithy and like snappy.
I think you're just jealous of their ability to be pithy and snappy.
It just feels manipulative.
They definitely market themselves as like a sustainable and morally virtuous company, and it has become hugely successful as this whole plant-based food revelation has kind of taken off, as we heard, in Germany and beyond. Which is why quite a lot of people got upset when it recently emerged that Oatly was selling a roughly 10% stake to a bunch of investors. The less controversial people on this list include Oprah and Natalie Portman. But leading this investment was a company called Blackstone. They are a private equity group. They manage nearly $600 billion of assets around the world, which is a kind of almost unimaginable amount of money. Why is it so controversial that this Swedish oat milk company is selling a stake to Blackstone? Fredrik Gerton seemed like the best person to talk about this. He is a Swedish filmmaker and he made an award-winning documentary last year called Push, which delves into why it has become so expensive to live in cities around the world and why poorer people are being forced out of them. Spoiler alert, it turns out Blackstone and other big investment companies have had a role to play in that. So we had a great chat with Fredrik about Oatly, Blackstone, and the ethical dilemmas that come with trying to make capitalism a little bit better.
You live in Malmo, a city that's home to this incredibly successful oat milk brand, Oatly, with all those pithy slogans and adverts that grab your attention in the street. This company has put sustainability at the center of their business model, and at least at the center of their marketing plan, that's for sure. Up until recently, was it a company that you were proud to share a city with?
Absolutely. And I have a lot of friends who work there. I even know the CEO, a lot of really good people. And that's the company everybody wants to work at. So, of course, when I reacted on Blackstone buying into Oatly, it became a big story because of my film Push, which is about the global housing market, where the biggest private equity fund in the world, Blackstone, is creating a lot of devastation for people's homes in cities around the world. Most people at Oatly have seen the film, you know, so people could understand that I was upset. And then suddenly I wrote a story in the local daily here, and then maybe it was almost like a month later, my first tweet about the story got picked up from somebody in the UK. And then I could see also a lot of big vegan influencers in the UK. It was like a big snowball rolling down the hill.
Can you explain for people who don't understand how global finance works very well or don't understand the housing market, what exactly this company has done that has made you so angry?
When we use this language, housing market, we are already one step wrong, you know, because housing a home is a human right. And that's like a part of the Human Rights Declaration that every nation has in their own legislation. But since the last financial crisis in 2008, we have a totally new global landlord. And these are the private equity funds. They found out that there was a lot of undervaluated assets out there. That's how they call homes. So around in 2012, 4 years after the crash, a lot of this kind of financial money went into our homes. And they found out that even homes where really poor people live, places where the cheapest rent, that was really a good place to put money and park money. So this has meant that Blackstone and others have been pushing up prices on homes around the world, you know, in from country to country. In the US, they bought a lot of single family homes. I mean, only in California, they bought 80,000 homes, you know, homes that never been under a big landlord before. But they, you know, this is like the new era. So people who lost their homes in the financial crisis, they suddenly had a new landlord. Many of them was actually also renting their own homes, but suddenly for a very expensive price. This business model has created a lot of grief, a lot of sadness, a lot of stress in cities around the world. And that's the story in my film Push. So it's not only about Blackstone, but it's about financialization of our homes, commodification. You know, when you treat a home like it was gold, like just another asset on the investment market.
So why would a company like this want to invest in a plant-based dairy alternative sustainable firm like Oatly?
Well, plant-based is a good business. And the thing with Blackstone is that they are so big. They are in, you know, hundreds of countries, and they are in boards of companies around the world, logistic companies, distributions, hotel. They own Hilton, for example. But I guess also that Oatly, in some way, they also want to go public. And when you want to go public, you want a partner who can pump up the value of your company.
Oatly's justification of this is really interesting, actually. They put a statement on their website saying, look, we are trying to save the planet here by getting as many people as possible to eat plant-based food. And that involves making our product as successful as possible. So we need all of this money being pumped in, which I can kind of see the logic of, even if it makes me uncomfortable. What do you make of that argument?
I mean, it's clear that Oatly understood that there would be criticism coming out of this. So they prepared a lot of talking points, and this is one of their prime talking points. I mean, the CEO wrote an answer to my article, and he said basically that we could have gotten green money, green investors, but we prefer to have Blackstone. So we can almost like turn dirty money into, you know, future success. And of course, I think that's a very weak and not very honest point. I mean, you could also argue, why do we need a global oat milk company? Why did they have to grow so fast? They want to grow quick because they want to make more money.
I guess ultimately, Oatly are arguing that it's better to be on the inside. And we live in a capitalist society. You can't fight that, but you can maybe help to shape it. What do you think of this idea that we need to get big finance investing in green ideas as much as possible, rather than kind of shunning them and leaving them to just be evil?
Then I will ask you a question. Is there a line where you don't want to cross? What do you say about money made from refugee smuggling or selling of cocaine? Is that money okay or not okay? You know, you have to draw a line somewhere where the immoral of the business is too strong. You know, if somebody burning down Amazonas, would you take that money? I meet a lot of people who are also from the business community who congratulate me because they also want to be on the good side, try to do better. And then we have to isolate the evil forces. And Blackstone is one of them. It's like a business model where they don't really care. Business and morale. You know, we have to kind of connect these two words. And a lot of people think business is always the best, and they don't really care about what happens to people and the nature and the climate. So no, we have to, I don't really believe in those words, you know, that we say, that's kind of giving up. I don't think it's your own opinion you're putting it to me, but it's almost like giving up, saying that we should, they are too rich, so we better work with them. Okay.
One argument that I hear was put to you, I heard this on your podcast, that someone at Oatly was defending this by saying you had already changed Blackstone with your film Push, that the members of Blackstone have seen it, and that's why they're investing in Oatly.
That's sweet.
Yeah, really sweet argument.
It's sweet, but it's not honest, you know. It's like, yeah. And it's basically saying that the CEO writes, like, you and me, Frederick, we are changing the world. You changed Blackstone, I also do the same, you know. It's like, come on, you know, I'm a documentary filmmaker. I make very small money, and he sits on shares in that company. He's going to be stinking rich. He's close to buying his first yacht.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to even buy a little, you know, rowing boat, you know. So it's a bit silly and not honest.
I have a feeling that maybe this is backfiring for Blackstone, because so many people are responding negatively to this investment, and so many people that wouldn't have heard about Blackstone necessarily if they hadn't come across your film are now watching your film and are hearing about this because of Oatly. Do you see it that way? Do you think maybe it is backfiring?
I hope so, but I'm, you know, they're so big. They're flying in their own universe. But of course, they have never been a household name. You know, their clients are people who are stinking rich. You know, it's the high net worth individuals. Like, it's this kind of people who have too much money and the pension fund. So their clients know about them, but they don't really want other people to know about them. So, of course, now they're a little bit much more out in the open. And I think that's good. It's good because we as citizens need to understand the factors that are ruling our world, you know. Blackstone has been the masters of crisis. Whenever there's been a crisis, they always grow stronger, which means that we all have to look out for what are they going to do now. I mean, their CEO, Schwartzman, said that we're sitting on 1.5 trillion in dry powder. Dry powder meaning a lot of money ready to go, to be invested. And of course, if we want to change the world, we should work to isolate them. And I think there is a way to isolate them, and that's by asking your own pension fund, your own banks, to divest Blackstone. And it has happened since my film that I know banks have taken their money out.
I'm guessing there's no sign that Blackstone has changed its behavior when it comes to housing since you made your film and there's more attention on it.
No, of course not. Of course not. They keep going. They keep going.
Through making this film, you met a lot of people all around the world, people who are really suffering from the effects of investments from companies like Blackstone. But I was wondering whether you could close by telling us of some examples of people you met around the world that are doing good work to try and stop this problem and to find ways around providing affordable housing for people who need it so much.
First of all, it's almost like a defensive fight, but you can see that cities and countries are doing that. So, for example, Berlin has voted into a rent cap, a 5-year rent cap, in order to kind of make it less interesting for this kind of short-term money to invade the city. The Denmark has made something else. It's almost like called Lex Blackstone. And also Barcelona, Madrid. So it's happening in many cities that they say, okay, we need to fight this monster. So the film has been a part of the local debate in many countries. First of all, make it less interesting for them to come to your city. It's a very good first step.
Did you see that someone created a clever, like, satire of the Oatly ads, but referring to this? They wrote, as you read this ad, our investors are burning down the Amazon. And then the next poster is, you think we're joking? And then, ha ha. I should mention that Blackstone deny that they are burning down the Amazon. There is a statement on their website responding to this allegation. But it is something that is being thrown at them by critics, and they are involved with some companies that don't quite tie in to the Oatly brand, that's for sure.
I watched Frederick's documentary this week and was left enraged at the general state of things when it comes to housing. But like he says, it's not all doom and gloom, and there are a lot of people trying to fix the mess that it's housing. And you should definitely check out the film. It's called Push, and it sets out the problem, but also celebrates people who are trying to find solutions in Barcelona and Berlin and beyond. We will link to that in the show notes. And you should also check out Frederick's podcast, where he talks about all of this stuff in depth with Leilani Faha, who's the former UN special rapporteur that you see a lot in the film. And they actually did a podcast specifically about the Oatly issue.
And I listened to their one yesterday about Airbnb, which I thought was a really subtle and interesting discussion of that complicated topic. It wasn't just like the Airbnb bashing that you hear on the streets in Amsterdam from people who are mainly just pissed off about Rolly suitcases.
Your husband.
Not my husband, my neighbour. Yeah, you're right, my husband.
What else are you listening to or watching this week?
Well, I realised the last few weeks I've given quite like half-hearted recommendations to some rather trashy TV shows. So today I'm raising the bar and going all in, recommending an absolutely brilliant book of essays I read by the Irish writer Emily Pine. It's called Notes to Self, and maybe by describing it as a book of essays, I make it sound really dry and academic, but it is anything but. It's a most gripping, page-turning set of essays about life, death, hospitalization, reproduction, and female blood. And Pine has that amazing ability to express personal stories in a way that seemed to encapsulate the human experience both individually and universally. I found it really moving and enjoyable. So go get it from your local independent bookshop. Notes to Self by Emily Pine.
Sounds great.
What about you?
I think probably everyone's expecting me to recommend Emily in Paris, this Netflix series about an American girl moving to Paris and kind of being awful. I'm not going to do that. I got stuck into Kidnapping this week. Have you heard about this?
No. I mean, I've heard of Kidnapping.
As a concept. Kidnapping the series is the new Scandi crime thriller series that has been brought out by Arte. Is it called Arte? I don't really know how to pronounce it.
Yeah, that's one of those things I'm always really awkward about and I just avoid saying it.
I think it's Arte with an accent. By Arte, the Artifarty TV network. And the thing about this series is that it's Scandi, but it's also French. It is European AF. And it's about an investigation into a child trafficking network that stretches all the way from Denmark to France to Poland. I'm not that far into it yet, but it is pretty good. And I'm enjoying watching such a multilingual show that kind of celebrates the magic of subtitles.
That sounds really bleak.
It is quite bleak, but also kind of, it's gripping.
Okay. I might give it a go. If it's not too graphic, then I do love a thriller. Do they have English subtitles? Final question.
Not sure about that. I am watching it in France, and it's definitely available in France or a computer that thinks it's in France. Can I say that?
Stop with the encouraging people to use a VPN and steal television.
I'm absolutely not doing that. I don't know what you're talking about, Dominic. But what I mean to say is I'm not sure whether you might have subtitle options in a different country. I suspect that you would.
Okay.
Doesn't have English subtitles here, so I've been watching it in Danish with French subtitles, which is very bad for my brain.
Katie, I'm sorry, this doesn't fit quite into the food theme. I couldn't find a food happy ending.
You were doing so well.
I know. It's about parrots, and maybe some people somewhere eat parrots.
Yes, they probably shouldn't, but yeah.
Anyway, I'm here to tell you about the news that 5 parrots have had to be separated at Lincolnshire Wildlife Park, taken away from public view because they were telling visitors to fuck off.
Oh, I love a sweary parrot.
Yeah, and it's normal for parrots to swear. But the thing is, it's quite difficult to get them to stop swearing once they've started, because apparently when they get a startled or laughing response from the humans, it just makes them want to do it more. And because of all the kids visiting this wildlife park, and because the 5 parrots were really setting each other off and it was getting worse, they decided they had to separate them and take them to different parts of the zoo, some of them actually out of view.
They're in detention.
Yes. The reason why I wanted to talk about this isn't just because it's fun to have sweary parrots, but also because one of their parrot colleagues at the Lincolnshire Wildlife Park is this famous parrot called Chico, who went viral a few months ago because he's really good at singing Beyoncé. Can we play a clip?
Yes, we can. It's so kind of lusty.
It's really impressive technique.
You could learn a thing or two from that parrot.
I could do, yeah. I've been studying it. That's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for joining us once again. I hope everyone's doing well wherever you are, and we'll be back next week. Don't you worry.
I am off to eat some discretionary indulgences now.
I want a croissant.
If you just can't get enough of the Europeans, you can find us on various social networks. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, and Facebook. If you just type in the Europeans Podcast, you should find us.
I will try and remember to share that clip of the parrot for everyone to listen to and share with all their friends on our Facebook page. So head over there.
See you next week, everyone.
Bye.
Fabule.